From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those of us who heard him call a game, Utah Jazz play-by-play man Hot Rod Hundley seemed like a natural. And there's a new documentary film that helps explain why. He was good at it because he played the game. Played for the Lakers in the NBA, had a brilliant college career. So his analysis, even the way he explained what was happening right then on the floor, came from this kind of hands-on familiarity that was rare in broadcasting. His former partner and player, Ron Boone, says in the film, Hot Rod would sometimes call the play before it would actually happen. Today in the program, we're talking about Hot Rod Hundley. The documentary explores his complicated but always entertaining life. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out the Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Utah Jazz was the last NBA basketball franchise to do what they call a simulcast. It's where you have the same play-by-play announcers do both radio and TV. And the reason Utah held out for so long was probably Hot Rod Hundley. The longtime play-by-play announcer for the team managed to call a game in both mediums. In fact, even after the simulcast days were over, a lot of us would turn down the TV and turn up Rod on the radio. He had this cadence to the way he called a game, and when you got into his rhythm, you could follow the flow of it even without the pictures. In the John Stockton, Carl Malone days of the team, none of us will forget the call Hundley made when John hit that three-pointer in Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals in Houston.
Tied at 100, Game 6 on the line here. Russell to Stockton. Stock for three. Stock got it. Unbelievable. John Stockton. John Stockton. It's over. The Jazz win it. We're on our way to the World Championship in Chicago.
Now listen to that. There was no dispassion in Hot Rod Hundley's voice. It is a point that is made in a new documentary film about him. When the shots were falling for the team, Hot Rod was as excited as any of the fans. When they weren't, he could get sullen, even disgusted, as someone points out. But the film is about Hot Rod Hundley's gifts as a play-by-play man, for sure. It's also deeply personal, about a tragic childhood in West Virginia, and the way basketball helped him out of it, but also allowed him to hide a part of himself. Today in the program, we're talking about the film. It's called Hot Rod. Dan Lohman directed it. Dan worked as a sports broadcast producer, including covering 5 Olympics. He's produced a number of documentary films. He is founding member of Pikewood Creative. It's a video production company based in Morgantown, West Virginia. And I should mention that Hot Rod premiered this weekend, but there are still going to be television screenings this month. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Dan Lohman is at a conference in Las Vegas, and he's joining us from a studio there. And Dan, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I wanted to start with something you've talked about. You first produced a feature about Hot Rod. This was a long time ago, or a while back anyway, when you were a grad student at West Virginia. Did you know much about Hot Rod at the time?
I didn't know much about him. When you grow up in Morgantown, you have a sense of who the sports heroes are, and he was one of them. He's at the very top of the list, along with Jerry West. So as I went into producing that feature, I learned more about him as a player, what he was doing on the floor. You'd always heard about the antics and the clowning that he had done, but really I started to dig a little deeper into that, and we uncovered some films and some clips of him that were just quite honestly unbelievable. And so at that time, it really opened up a kind of a question for me, not that I thought about it too much at the time, but you know, why was he doing these sort of things?
Yeah. But explain what you mean by that. What was unbelievable about it? Was it that he was just goofing around, or the extraordinary talent he had? What was it?
It was more the goofing around, quite honestly. Yeah. He was a great player. He could do so many things on the basketball floor. as you would normally watch a game. He could pass the ball extremely well. He could shoot the ball. But what he was doing was just unbelievable material, such as he would spin the ball off of his arm and back around him, and then he would point at the defender. He would shoot a hook shot from the foul line in a conference tournament game when the all-time scoring record for the tournament is on the line.
Yeah.
These things just never happened before in basketball, and they've never happened since.
When did you learn about the deeper part of the story, and when did it occur to you that you wanted to make a feature film about Hot Rod?
Really, it was when he passed away. He was so beloved in West Virginia as he was in Utah. And so when he passed away, I was just kind of doing my normal reading of, you know, following up on the story, as we all do, about the legends in our lives and the heroes that we've followed. And when I read a story that appeared actually in the Deseret News, there were things in that story that I had never known. And it just opened a doorway for me that said, there is so much more to this character than I ever knew. Hmm. While others may have known that, it wasn't widely known. And at that point, we said, this is something that needs to be done.
It seems like one of the themes in the film that I detected was this idea of home, how he thought about West Virginia in particular. And the film sort of comes back around to that idea. But that idea of like place and home, and even though it was, there weren't a lot of happy memories in some ways in a certain part of his childhood, but that he did think about that place as home. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, he really did. As much as he wanted to get out of Charleston, West Virginia, later on in life, as it comes back to be revealed in the film and through interviews, is that that's all he wanted to do, was to come back home. And so he did have, I think, a deep sense of where he came from, in particular, how he was raised by other people mm-hmm. in his life, not his parents. I think that made a profound impact on who he was, and it stuck with him for the entirety of his life. But I think that sense of what those years meant to him, because it was sad how his life was taken from him, his childhood was taken from him mm-hmm. to a degree, and he was a survivalist.
Yeah.
And then later on, as he's trying to make a name for himself in college basketball, he remains in West Virginia. And at that time, he just became the absolute star of the college basketball world. And that's a tough thing to do for any athlete, to become such a major story, and he was. And so I think that in those formative years, he was just so beloved by so many people. And in the end, it was, again, so many years later, all he wanted to do was come back home to West Virginia.
One of the things you must have confronted early on was the irony of the fact that he didn't have much of a father. His father didn't play much of a role, and as you tell quite honestly in the film, that he wasn't much of a father himself, nor much of a husband for that matter. How did you think about the kinds of questions you were going to ask of the people who were close to him, and the kind of honesty you had to really tell to make this film what it is?
That's a good question. You know, the three components of this film that make it what it is are the three interviews with his daughters, quite honestly. There are many other interviews that are wonderful, and people were just so honest and telling stories about him. But his three daughters are the ones who really unlock the doors to say, here's what it was. Here's who Hot Rod really was behind the scenes as a father, as a husband. And I do think that many of the things that he struggled with in his life, you know, they can be traced back to his early days growing up without his father. And his father was he oddly was around the streets of Charleston, West Virginia, and Hot Rod would come upon him and see him once in a while, but they'd never really interacted. They would just almost look at each other as like casual acquaintances. And it was just this interesting dynamic as I learned about that relationship. But later on, as you know, his daughters were telling these stories of who he was, and you know, very, very honestly, some of the most private moments of their lives, he comes across as somebody that was, I think, trying to be a good father, but he just struggled with the ability. He didn't have the background to know how to do that. He never had that role model in his life to do so. And so when we decided what we were going to ask the daughters, we went into that really with just kind of it was an open book. And our interviewer, Tony Caridi, who's the producer of the film, it does an incredible job of being able to understand what direction to take an interview. And we just don't have that list of questions. We have an idea where we want the conversation to go, but it's really the magic in this is that you just get people to a comfort level that they just open up and they forget the cameras are there and they just share their life.
But were there any ground rules at the beginning? I mean, did you say to the girls, his daughters, Kimberly, Jennifer and Jackie, did you say, look, we need to talk about some kind of difficult stuff. Are you willing to do that? Did you have to talk them into it? Did you give them, I'm sure you gave them fair warning, but what did they make of the difficult part of the story that they had to tell?
Sure. And we did. And we told them, you know, we want to go through these parts of his life because this is the real story. And as we tell this documentary, we want to share openly who this person was. And they were fine with that. You know, some of the stories that came through, though, we had no idea about them until they shared them.
Yeah.
We had ideas of where they were going to go.
Right.
But at the same time, we had no idea where it was going to go. And so that was the big reveal in this film.
Let me play a moment from this part. One of the things you reveal in the film is that Hot Rod Hundley has three daughters with his second wife, Flo. Never divorces Flo, and we'll get back to that in a moment. It's interesting. They lived apart, completely apart in some ways. He moved away from his family. I think this was in the mid-70s. They moved back to Phoenix, and he never lived together with them again. Now, we would go visit them on occasions. It was almost like they had these moments of being a family, but he never actually lived with them. And at this point in the film, we hear from his daughter, Jennifer, and also his daughter, Kimberly, talking a little bit about that. There's also an interesting moment in this section where we hear from Frank Layden, former general manager and coach of the Utah Jazz, talking about his perception of that, I'll put it in quotes, family. Here's a moment from the film Hot Rod.
We just packed everything up and moved back to the home in Phoenix because we hadn't sold the home, so we moved to the same house. You're a kid, and it's just the way it was. I'm like, my dad travels for his job and comes home when he can. That's all I thought about it. I didn't realize, you know, it wasn't normal to live in another state.
He still always had that, you know, positive attitude when he came home and happy to see us, but you know, kids wasn't really his thing.
And he knew it. Like, he was not there for us. He didn't know what the hell to do with us.
I went to his house for Thanksgiving dinner. And he had his daughters. And at that day, I saw a different Hot Rod. And the girls were the usual girls. They were having fun with him. And there was a lot of warmth there. And this was sort of a different level Hot Rod Hundley I'd seen. Hot Rod Hundley competed to get above everybody else, you know. But he was down and almost like, you know, the great American dad. And I felt kind of privileged that I had entered a domain that a lot of people hadn't been in.
This is so interesting, I think, because on one hand, he was a terrible father. I mean, it's very clear in the film, and his daughters know it, they say it. But then there was this other part of him. How do you explain that? What Frank said, he saw, you know, that I guess it just gets at what you were saying before. He didn't really know how to do this in some ways. It's not a great excuse, but it's something.
No, it's not. And, you know, people go through hardships all the time. And people have, you know, not had fathers in their lives. And they've overcome and become, you know, incredible fathers themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's not an excuse. But at the same time, you could see these moments in his life, and in particular in the film clips that we received from the Hundley family, from the daughters, you could feel and sense that he loved his daughters. He loved his family. It was just that he struggled with these moments of how does he complete the circle,
yeah,
and be totally committed. And the look into their lives in particular, when I saw those film clips for the first time, that was a wow moment to see, to get that peek inside. And that's something that no one had ever seen.
Yeah. Let's go back to his childhood that may explain the kind of the persona that he puts together to hide, I think, the sadness in his life. I mean, he became this sort of clown on the floor, and even as a broadcaster, in many ways to kind of hide some of the sadness that he had. And I wanted you to talk about, there's a moment that you have an actor read comments by his mother. Would you set this up for us? I want you to talk a little bit about this. His father basically abandons them, and his mother has to work. And so she has to go from place to place to try to find people to take care of him. But she just comes across as exhausted and poor and really desperate in many ways.
And she was. And I think she was trying to do her best to make this work. And she had this baby, and as she traveled the streets from one place to the next, she wanted to have a home for her son, but it just was not working. And so one of the things in the film that we felt very strongly about was that we had to convey very clearly what happened to Hot Rod early in his life. I had seen many videos, I'd read things, and they gave descriptors such as, you know, Hot Rod grew up on the hard scrabble streets of Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Well, what did that mean? Yeah. You know, what was the context to that? And so we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how are we going to get this across properly? Because that sets the tone for the rest of his life. And so we took the words from his mother, which were, you know, fortunately given to a writer in the book Clown. And so we took those words that we could hear come alive as we just read them to each other, but they really came alive when we had our voiceover artist record these lines for us. And then with the animation, we wanted to give a really, really clear look into what was it like? What was it like to feel like Hot Rod walking those streets with his mother?
Rod stayed 5 or 6 different places over the years. I wanted to keep him, but oh God, I couldn't make a living. I always wanted to be with him. One lady didn't want me to see him. I found out she whipped the blood out of him. He was 17 months old. I took him away from her and gave him to somebody else. Many of them mistreated him. One lady beat him so bad, I found blue marks all over his little body, and I started to cry, and I just picked him up, and I took his pitiful few belongings, and I said I was leaving with my son, and that was that, and we went out into the night.
Dan, what happens after that? Because he's basically raised by, this is another sad part of the story, taken in by a well-intentioned and lovely elderly couple, but really they didn't seem to have the capacity to be able to raise a small boy.
Right. They were doing their best to help out Rod and his mother. And he lived with them for a while, and this was, you know, what he called home. But he lived under, you know, he lived underneath a staircase, or I should say he slept underneath a staircase at this house. And so, they did their best, and They were wonderful people, according to everybody that we talked to. But they were older,
yeah.
And so you're kind of overwhelmed, I think, by what do you do with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, Hot Rod started to become his own person very early on in his life, and I think that was formative for him as well to become the person who he was for the rest of his life, because he had to learn how to survive.
Yeah.
He had to learn how to wow a crowd early. How could he win over somebody to get what he needed very early in his life?
At what point do you figure he realized basketball may be his way out of that life.
I think once he saw that he had this gift, that he could take a ball and he would fire it behind his back at a wall and it would come back to him, that he said, hey, you know, I might have something here as a young kid. And as he's getting up towards 10, 11 years old, he starts to go to the YMCA in Charleston. And it's there that he is just being a kid on the sidelines watching the older kids play. And fortunately, the YMCA let him in for free. They knew this was a kid that just needed a place. And you talk about, how advanced was the YMCA seeing that, hey, this kid has no way to be able to afford to come in here, but we're going to open the door for him. And that changed his life. So he started to become this basketball player because that was kind of his refuge. And these older players said one time they didn't have enough players. They had one short. And they were older guys. They were up towards their college years. And here's this little kid, Rod Hundley, who they let play once. And as they say in the film, from then on, that was Hot Rod Hundley playing with them.
Dan Lohman is with us. His film was called Hot Rod, which premiered this past weekend on AT&T Sportsnet. It's going to be airing again throughout the coming months. It'll air again this coming Sunday. You can visit us at RadioWest.org for the details. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the great Hot Rod Hundley. He, of course, was the longtime play-by-play man for the Utah Jazz, and it was his voice that a lot of us thrilled to in those Stockton and Malone days. There's a new documentary about Hundley that tells about his exploits and gifts as a broadcaster and player, but it's also really personal and incredibly honest. It's called Hot Rod. The director is Dan Lohman, and he's joining us today in the program to talk about Hot Rod Hundley. I wanted to, Dan Lohman, ask you about just how good he was. It's interesting to see some of the headlines you include in the film from those days where he scores like 42 points. He's averaging 29 points as a freshman, how he's rewriting the record books. I mean, he was a sensation.
He was. He was an incredible player. A lot of the attention that Hot Rod receives to this day is because of what he did as a clown, as they said, and how he would joke around on the floor and do all these sort of things, shooting hook shots from the foul line and so on. But he was a tremendous basketball player. He was scoring at incredible rates in his high school career and then as a freshman at West Virginia. And that's really when it started, this clowning, because he almost became bored in games. He was just racking up points at a rate that few people had seen. And so it opened this door for him to entertain people in a different way, not just as a basketball player, but as an entertainer. But as he continued on in his career, he continued to be a phenomenal player, how he could shoot the ball, how he could pass the ball. He was 6'4" and bringing the ball up and down the basketball floor, which at that time was not very normal. You know, bigger guys played towards the inside, towards the basket. He was this point guard, bringing the ball up and down the floor and distributing in a way that was just extraordinary. So he became this legend around especially West Virginia, but then also up in New York City. You know, the New York Daily News devoted an entire back page to Hot Rod Hundley on their Sunday edition. And at that time, in the middle of basketball season, that's incredible. So he was gaining attention around the country at a rate that was, second to none. It was something that he was doing all on his own by becoming this star as a basketball player. And they wanted to come see him as a player, but also to see the show maybe when the game got out of hand.
Here's another moment from the film. He makes this, I don't know if it was an agreement, they shook hands on or anything like that, but there was this basic arrangement with Hot Rod and his college coach that the idea was, look, you play it straight if the game is on the line. If not, you know, you can go ahead and do your little clown act. And Bob Smith, a good friend of his, of course, and one of the players on the team, talks a little bit about just kind of some of his antics. Here's another moment from the film.
We have a timeout. Rod's not in the huddle. Well, back then you had the old mops and they had like the white fringe coming down. Well, all of a sudden, the timeout is over. We're on the floor. Here comes Rod running out and he's got the mop over his head and the place absolutely goes berserk. Several times after a timeout, we can't find Rod. He's in the stands eating popcorn with people. One time that we were playing, Rod had gone down, jumped up to the rim, was sitting on the rim waiting for us to come back on the floor. And the people absolutely loved it. The more they cheered, the more Rod went into his act. We're at a timeout. Rod says, let's go in a football formation. So we line up and center the ball to Rod. He drop kicks the ball and hits the backboard. And the place again goes crazy. We didn't know that was going to happen. That was Rod.
I think it's Craig Bowlerjack who says in the film that he could have been a Globetrotter. I mean, it was just crazy. And you know what's interesting about this, though? And this is the kind of the serious side to that, to all of that. And you make it clear in the film that on some level, yes, he was the clown, but part of this was him sort of hiding this darker part of himself. But also, in some ways, it seemed like he couldn't buckle down. The antics, the goofing around are the thing that really kept him from being kind of truly great in some ways, too.
In some ways, yes, because he just had this almost insatiable appetite that he needed to put on a show.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I read early in the research was when he did one of these clowning bits early on, he said, I could feel it right down to my bones when the crowd cheered. So I think it became a bit of a drug for him that he just had to do this because he knew the response that he was going to get. And these were things we could have gone on for another 30 minutes of stories that you would not believe that he did. He after a basket one time, he makes the basket, goes around the back where they're selling concessions, grabs a hot dog, and comes out on the other side as his teammates are coming down to the other end of the floor. He sits on the other team's bench during a timeout, and the coach is going crazy from the other team saying, get him off the bench, get him out of here. And Rod said, well, show me in the rule book where it says I can't do this.
Right.
He was doing all these things. And at first when you hear him, you go, oh, come on, this can't be true. These things are just outlandish. And every single person we talk to, and they're coming out of the woodwork now to confirm all these stories as well, even though we had confirmed them with many people, everybody is saying, yep, that's exactly what he did.
It was also interesting in the film, and I think Jerry West is the one who points this out, former, as you say, basketball great, and also from West Virginia. Boy, they had some pretty great, two great guys from West Virginia in those days. But Jerry points out that, you know, he was more than a clown, and that he had, there's this really nice moment, I want to play this section from the film, where he also had a pretty fragile kind of self-perception in some ways. It seems like this. There's the moment that Bob Smith talks about in the film about they go on this losing streak, three-game losing streak, and Rod really begins to worry about his future in the sport, whether he's going to be drafted. It's a really kind of a poignant story, and it reveals kind of how fragile he was in some ways. Let's play this moment from the film. This is Bob Smith.
Rod and I went back to the hotel, and for the first time, he opened up to me. Rod knew that time was running out. He said to me, I'm not going to graduate. He said, the way I'm playing basketball, he said, if I'm not drafted, I don't know what I'll be able to do. He said, and I'm not playing good. He said he was a phony. He said, I stink. He said, I don't know what to do about it. Basically, half the night we stayed up and talked.
He cried?
Yes, cried like a baby, so did I.
What was that about, do you think? It seems like he was compensating for some pain in some ways.
I think he was. I think he had come upon this streak that he just was not accustomed to.
Yeah.
And I think that that was one of those moments where Bob Smith saw who Hot Rod really was. That was something that you didn't see much from out of Hot Rod. He just did not open those doors to people very often. So when they did become open and he showed that side that was vulnerable, it was almost a shock. And so for them to sit in the hotel room that night and for Rod to be contemplating his future based on this losing streak, and I think also leading up to that point in his senior year, it was kind of a moment of this gig is going to be up here in a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and what am I going to do? And so I think it was kind of in the back of his mind, but then it was underscored by this really rough patch of three games. And I think he had such high expectations at that point because this was a show that was something people had to see. Mm-hmm. They were lining up hours in advance at the door to come see Hot Rod do all this stuff. So for him to open up in that way and for the door to be cracked, that was really a poignant moment.
He does make it to the NBA, of course, but this is one of the questions that comes up. Now, he goes to the Lakers were with Minnesota in those days. And this was interesting. Jerry West talked about how it was a very different place, the league in those days. It was a really dirty league, and the game was different. And it seems like Rod had a hard time adapting. Explain that. What was it like in those days, do you think?
I think it was just a much more difficult jump for Hot Rod than he thought it was going to be. He had dominated at such a high level in college that once he stepped into the pro level, the NBA, and he was the number one draft choice in 1957,
yeah.
That doesn't guarantee you success.
Right.
And so as he entered through the pathway of the NBA, I think he figured out there's a whole lot of good players out here. And so he struggled to maybe be as fast as those guys. And the things that he was able to do in college weren't working as well in the NBA. And so when at times he would start to do his clowning bit, it wasn't as well received because it was a different level. It was a different era. It was a different situation. And so he also had a hard time controlling himself off the floor. He talks about how he wasted an opportunity. He's very open about that.
Yep.
And a lot of people underscore that as well.
There was a former Lakers coach who mentions, and you cite this in the film, that Hot Rod Hundley never became the professional player he could have become. How do you make as a sort of a sports observer, Dan, what do you think about Hot Rod Hundley in the NBA? I mean, he played in just more than 400 games. Averaged about 9 points a game, I guess. What was it? He shot 35% from the field. What can you say about Hot Rod Hundley as a player in the NBA?
He had his moments. He did have some games where he scored at a very high level. He had those times where I think he felt like he was Hot Rod again. He was back in his element. But overall, he did not live up to the expectations that I think he had set upon himself and that others had put upon him. He was disappointed with that. He did make two NBA All-Star teams, which is a great accomplishment.
Yeah.
He was playing with a lot of great players back then, so that was definitely a feather in his cap. However, when he looks back on it and when most people look back at it, that's kind of a point of his story that gets scrubbed over because it just was kind of an average NBA career, and Hot Rod was not an average guy. So this was something that he struggled with. And with his teammates, they would struggle to make airplanes as well. You know, he was a guy that was just so interested in the game after the game that I think he just lost focus.
Well, as we'll talk about when we come back from a break, when he starts to really dedicate himself to a craft, it's – after he quits playing and becomes a broadcaster. Dan Lohman is with us. His film is called Hot Rod, premiered this past weekend on AT&T Sportsnet. It's going to air again this coming Sunday. You can visit us at radiowest.org for details about the showings of the film. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dan Lohman is with us today in the program. We're talking about his documentary film about the great Hot Rod Hundley. It's called Hot Rod. It premiered over the weekend on AT&T Sportsnet. There are going to be a number of other airings. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Dan is joining us to talk about it. So how is it that Hot Rod Hundley managed to become a broadcaster, a play-by-play man? Was it inevitable in some ways or not?
I think as you look back at his life, Doug, I think it was.
Yeah.
Because he was always entertaining. Again, going back to his early years on the streets of Charleston, he was finding ways to charm people. He had an innate ability to do so. And so I think that as he picked up these talents that he didn't even know he was picking up, but also they were God-given as well, that he could tell a story in a great, great way by just talking to somebody in a room. If you came upon him, you knew Hot Rod was going to give you a memory that you would cherish for a long time. And so he took this talent and seized the opportunity in broadcasting, which came after he was working for Converse. He was out selling shoes on the East Coast and ended up back in Los Angeles. And from there, I think he really found what he needed to be doing in life, because it came, I think, easily in a way, but he also worked very hard at his craft because he didn't want to blow another big opportunity.
Yeah. Talk about Chick Hearn. Talk about great play-by-play people. That he was one of them, and he really had a profound influence on Hot Rod.
He did. He was so lucky to be sitting next to Chick Hearn, the legendary Los Angeles Laker broadcaster, and he was with the team for so long, and so many people know that name. But it was early on in Chick Hearn's career that Hot Rod was sitting next to him and was an analyst with Chick. And at that time, Chick was not used to having other people on the broadcast with him, and so Rod did a lot of listening. He didn't do a whole lot of talking at that time because Chick dominated the broadcast. But as Hot Rod would say, he got the greatest training he could ever receive by just sitting there and having the headphones on and listening to the cadence and the rhythm of Chick Hearn.
He had a gift. There is no doubt about it. I have to say, it's just as a jazz fan, hearing those. I mean, I was one of those people who would turn down the TV and turn up the radio to listen to Rod, and there was just such a strange kind of natural ability that he had to, you knew what was, it's not always easy to listen to basketball being, you know, being announced on the radio. And Hot Rod was particularly good. What do you figure was his gift? What was he good at?
He was good at understanding the game. He understood what was going on the floor. And he understood how to communicate that. It is not an easy thing to do, to broadcast a basketball game on the radio and do it well.
Yeah.
People can do it, but to do it well is really hard. And he was doing that. He was painting pictures in every game, and people could envision what was happening. He would find ways to interject his sayings that people would love.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was very real, and people appreciated that as well. So he was the lifeline. It was something that people just yearned for. To have his voice on the air, whether it was in the car, whether it was in the house when they turned down the sound on the TV so they could hear Hot Rod on the radio, they just wanted to hear that voice that, again, he just had a gift to be able to communicate, and he was constantly telling stories.
You have some of his former colleagues, greats themselves in some ways. Dick Enberg is featured in the film. Jim Nantz is in the film as well. And Brent Musburger at this moment from the film when he talks about Hot Rod Hundley's talent.
What you find out with athletes when they move into broadcasting, they rely pretty much on their background and what they knew as a player. If you come over to the play-by-play side, you have got to learn about everybody else. You've got to kind of put your ego aside. It's an entirely different discipline, and I think much more difficult for an ex-player than it is somebody like myself. And I think to develop that demands a skill that very few athletes possess. And that's why it's so rare.
When he comes to Utah, now he goes to be the play-by-play person for New Orleans when they were the New Orleans Jazz. What does he come to mean to Utah? Because it seems like his connection, certainly early on, was kind of critical.
Yeah, it was, because they needed somebody to be the spokesperson. The Jazz needed somebody to stand out above the crowd and to give fans a reason to come to the games, to listen to the games, to be involved with the franchise. And that's a hard thing to do. And Hot Rod was the perfect guy for the perfect time. He came with a personality. He came with charisma. But he also came with the ability to translate to this fan base the highs and the lows of the Jazz in those early years. And people gravitated towards him. I think that one of the most telling parts of the entire film is when Frank Layden talks about that they hired a pollster. Yeah. To say, tell us who is the most popular Utah Jazz player in that particular year. And they gave him all the choices. And there were some big names there.
Yeah.
Adrian Dantley, Daryl Griffith, big names, Mark Eaton.
Yeah.
And who gets voted as the most popular Jazz person is Hot Rod Hundley.
Right. Yeah, Jim Nantz says that Hot Rod breathed life into the team, even when they were bad. And I wanted you to say a little bit more about that, because I don't know if it's typical, or maybe you see it as typical in some ways. You've got the play-by-play people for teams are often fans themselves. It's not like they're dispassionate broadcasters. But Hot Rod really got invested in these games. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you could tell when he was excited, but you could also tell when he was not so excited. And that's something you deal with in the film.
Exactly, because people want to feel your enthusiasm and your passion through the calls. And sometimes people that are announcing games now, that's forced. It's not real. But for Hot Rod, it was completely real. It was so passionate from the time that the team came to Utah, even when they weren't winning very much, he was still full of passion. People appreciated that. When they were doing well, he got excited, and he loved it when they won, and he really didn't like it when they lost or they did something silly, because he knew the game. Again, it goes back to how well he understood basketball. And for a former player to move into a play-by-play role, not an analyst, but a play-by-play man, is just incredibly rare. And for him to do it so well and to connect to a fan base was extraordinary. So I think that It was a match between a broadcaster and a fan base that is just not seen today. There are examples that you could go find and say, well, here or there, that these folks love their announcer. But Hot Rod was just standing above everybody else, and it was amazing how much people appreciated what he was doing.
There are a number of clips that I wanted to pull from Hot Rod making the call on these really critical times, at least in those kind of that heyday for the Jazz in the late 90s. We already played the announcement when the Jazz went to the championship for the first time, that game six in Houston. Here's another moment I just wanted to play just for the heck of it, because it was so great. This is in 1996 when John Stockton gets the steals record. And, of course, Hot Rod Hundley is making the call.
Rebound to Rick Fox from Boston. Fox inside low left, Eric Williams. Stockton steals. There it is. Stockton stole the ball. Stockton stole the ball. He's the all-time leader in the history of the game. 2,311.
Stockton inside the key, back to Stockton. Right side, Chris Boyce for three. He got it.
What a way.
John Stockton, another assist and another steal. He has the record in the NBA along with his assist record. What a player.
It wasn't so bad that Chris Morris nailed the three either. That kind of made that such a perfect moment, I have to say. And there's so many of those when he would just absolutely get caught up. But isn't that the trick of being a good broadcaster, not getting so overwhelmed by it, but being in the moment? And he really seemed to be in the moment in those times.
He was. He was perfectly capturing what was happening. And his enthusiasm didn't get out of control. It was right at the perfect level that you could feel it. It would make people stand up and take notice. They were glued to the game. And he just brought that sense of how big the moment was, like in that call. He had the voice to do it, you know, that gravelly voice that just was addicting for the Jazz fans. But at the same time, he was along the way. He was on the ride for a lot of big moments. And it was like just that perfect ascension of someone's career to do that. And these people, again, as a West Virginian, I grew up knowing Hot Rod as this great player. I lived in Salt Lake for a period of time as well when I worked the Olympics. Yeah. I got a sense of how big he was. But I was blown away by how much people still just want to hear that voice, just want to hear that call one more time, because that sports is this great, it's reality television without a script at all, and it's the greatest reality television because you just don't know what's going to happen. And Hot Rod was sitting there and describing all this to the fans of the Jazz. Mm.
The film comes back around to Hot Rod's sad decline. He has Alzheimer's in the end. And his really, in some ways, I guess we could call it a reconciliation with his daughters, or at least them coming to terms with the man that he was and him trying to really make up for, I suppose, the fact for his absence in some ways. Kimberly, his daughter, she's terrific in the film, I have to say. The other daughters are as well, but her kind of brutal honesty in telling the story is kind of remarkable. She talks about a moment. We won't play it. I don't want to give too much away from the film, but where she talks about where she's able to let it go. Do you want to say something about that moment?
Yes. I think that Kimberly and the other daughters, Kimberly and her sisters, came to a point late in Hot Rod's life where they had a lot of reflection on what they had dealt with. And so we were fortunate that when we interviewed the girls, it was the day after his statue was unveiled at West Virginia. And I think they had a lot of memories coming back to them at that point. And so we caught them at the right time, quite honestly. They shared this moment, Kimberly did, that was extremely personal.
Yeah.
And to hear the resolution in that moment, in the midst of how she's telling it, and she tells it very poignantly.
Yeah.
I think says a lot about how she ended up looking at her father and the complex nature that he carried throughout his entire life.
Kimberly talked about how those 3 hours at a bar in West Virginia after that ceremony were so important. And it's kind of a lovely moment. Let me play this moment because I want to ask you about it. Here's Kimberly, Hot Rod Hundley's daughter.
With classic, I guess, West Virginia nonchalance, it wasn't like they weren't like, oh my God. They were like, yeah, Hot Rod. No kidding, you're Hot Rod's kid, huh? And I'm like, yeah. We're number 33 in your program, number one in your heart, right? And they're like, oh yeah. And then they just slowly started to tell us these stories. I was your father's water boy. And then somebody said, you don't understand. The streets were deserted, that nobody was home. Everybody was at the field house to watch Dad. And these people told me he brought this town together in a way that nobody else had ever done. And they said, do you understand what your father meant to this town? And I said, I'm starting to get it. We had tears in our eyes. And then they said to me, your father's a hero.
What do you think it was? What did she mean when she says that those 3 hours made them understand their father in a way they never understood before?
I think as each of us, you know, we think about our own families, there's certain things that sometimes we don't understand why our parents act the way they do, or sometimes we feel like there's a guard up at points and you say, I really wonder what it looks like, or what did they look like back in the day? How did they interact with people? And I think that they got a glimpse of that. It was almost like they were transported in time and they were standing outside this scene that was happening, but they were a part of it at the same time.
Yeah.
And so as they're watching this and they're hearing these stories from these people, these West Virginians who know Hot Rod inside and out as the basketball player and how much he meant to this town, as they hear that and they see how Hot Rod comes in and interacts and how these people light up as he comes into the bar, it was the aha moment for them. And it was really, for me, that was the most emotional part of the film for me to look at what it meant for them as daughters. They had so many rough patches with him. And then they had this incredible moment of, I think we get it. And those 3 hours, as they said, meant more to them maybe than any other time in their lives.
That's Dan Lohman. He directs the film Hot Rod, which premiered last weekend on AT&T Sportsnet. There are 2 more chances to watch it there this month. You can go to radiowest.org for the information about that. The next one is coming on Sunday. Dan joined us from a studio in Las Vegas. Dan Lohman, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Doug. My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.